Today on Against the Grain, when we on the left talk about the plight of the Palestinians, we usually talk about land, and rightly so. The dispossession of the Palestinians from their land has been a central element of the project of Israeli settler colonialism. But often what's forgotten is the question of Palestinian labor, its fundamental role in building the State of Israel, and the complexities of the oppression of Palestinians as workers. Andrew Ross, in his exploration of stone workers, brings Palestinian labor back into view. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with him about this crucial dimension of Palestinian livelihoods. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The dispossession of the Palestinians is replete with symbols, most famously that of the olive tree, felled by Israeli bulldozers. But as my guest argues, the stone that's found under Palestinian soil is as symbolically potent and consequential for the livelihoods of the Palestinians. In Stone Men, The Palestinians Who Built Israel, published by Verso, professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU, Andrew Ross, writes of the aesthetic and economic importance of the stones and the skilled workers who quarry, cut, and finish them. Andrew, the West Bank has two resources that Israel lacks. One is water, and the other is stone. Can you tell us about the latter, how abundant it is, and why is it so critical for the Israeli state?
You're right. There are these two resources that the West Bank has that Israel doesn't have, and up to 80 or 90% even of the water that the West Bank has is siphoned off using advanced pumping technologies by Israeli authorities. In the case of stone, it's a resource that that Palestinians pretty much control, and for the most part, the firms in the stone industry are Palestinian owned. And it's surprisingly, there is not any published study of the stone industry, which is one of the reasons that I, you know, undertook the research for the book and wrote the book. And I say surprisingly because it is, it's the biggest private sector employer on the West Bank. The industry is the biggest contributor to Palestinian GDP, and it's also the biggest source of exports from the West Bank. Astonishingly, for such a small population, Palestinians are the 12th largest stone producers in the world. I mean, not far behind the U.S. and in front of Russia. And this is largely because the central highlands of the West Bank host some of the best dolomitic limestone in the world. And so it's an extraordinary resource. Israeli construction industry pretty much depends on the supply. And in fact, up to 75% of the stone that is extracted and processed and fabricated in the West Bank ends up inside the Green Line in Israel, or is used in the settlements in the West Bank themselves. There are exports to other nation states in the region, but Israel takes, you know, the lion's share of the stone and is pretty much dependent on the stone for its own, you know, home building and a general construction industry. So it's a pretty crucial resource, and it's also a bit of a resource curse because, like many nations that are dependent on a single resource economically, and typically it's the case of petroleum or oil, it brings with it certain disadvantages. And in fact, the stone, the limestone in Palestine is often referred to as white oil for that reason. it really does ravage the environment and sicken the workforce in terms of the production impacts of it. So there are pros and cons of this industry for Palestinians themselves.
Sure, and I wonder if you could say a bit more about how dependent the Palestinians are themselves for work connected to stone and the industry of construction. Those who live in the occupied territories, and you do focus primarily on the West Bank in your book, how important is it for their livelihoods?
It's pretty central. It's and also the industry is kind of organized around the remnants of ancient and venerable craft of stonemasonry. Palestinians have been very well known for their stonemasons for centuries, and it's that craft has become industrialized since 1967 or so, when Israel effectively outsourced the business of stone quarrying to the West Bank. There are hardly any stone quarries inside Israel at this point in time. It's considered a dirty industry, and has been much more effective to take its supply from the West Bank. And as a result, the industry has become sort of industrialized in the West Bank. The wages in general, the wages that are offered by the industry are higher than in any other, of the manufacturing sector, the service sector on the West Bank. And, in terms of aggregate volume of jobs, if you include Palestinians who are involved in the construction industry, many of whom work inside Israel on a daily basis, probably the combination of jobs is as much as is provided in the public sector of the Palestinian economy, which is, the biggest source of jobs. So pretty crucial. The biggest irony, however, of course, is that quite literally the contents of Palestinian land, the innards of it, are being used to build out the Israeli state and the spreading archipelago of settlements that are part of that project.
Right, and you emphasize in your book, Stonemen, that there is a very complicated relationship between the land and the labor of Palestinians well preceding the establishment of the Israeli state, and that these two are very much tied together, the expropriation of land and the exploitation of Palestinian labor. So I'd like to ask you about that history, starting with the period before the British Mandate of Ottoman Palestine, when Jewish settlers motivated by Zionist ideals came to the region. How did Jewish migrants to Palestine at that point depend on Palestinian labor, especially around working around stone?
Well, they had no, prior experience of construction and for the most part of manual labor. So, that part of settler labor has been much lionized, and in terms of the answer to the question, who built Israel, which is a large part of my book, most people think, well, Zionist pioneers who had no prior experience, but who learned on the job, who staffed the cement mixers, who, balanced the bricks awkwardly on their shoulders and learned how to become new Jews or made new Jews of themselves through this nation-making toil. That's certainly the mythology, and it's a Zionist mythology. But the actual labor history is much more murky if you delve into it, which is why I tried to do this in the book. And it turns out that from an early point, Palestinian skilled labor in this field was always the preferred labor force, and still is. Through thick and thin, Palestinians have always been the preferred labor force in construction, and initially largely because they were cheaper to hire, because Jewish pioneers, many of them were socialists, demanded their workers' rights and higher wages. They demanded a European wage as opposed to a local Levantine wage. And also because the workers were more skilled. They had centuries of experience, building, construction experience in the region. They were also a little less strident in their labor politics. And so these were some of the reasons why private employers in construction, initially at least, preferred Arab labor and depended almost entirely on it. That preference, as I said, is an abiding one. And despite efforts to replace or exclude Arabs from the workforce over the course of the last century or so, to this day, they really still are the core component of the construction workforce.
One of the things that you write about is the exclusion of Arab labor under Zionist ideology, which waxed and waned during different periods, but mm-hmm. tied to a notion that certainly in the early 20th century, a Zionist notion that Jewish-owned businesses should only employ Jewish labor, partly connected to this notion of Zionist self-reinvention of Jews, not as middlemen, but as those who work with their hands as manual laborers. And as you said, that's part of this Zionist mythology. Tell us about the exclusion of Arab workers, which, as you're saying, has always been complicated because those were the most skilled workers. In the period of, well, the early 20th century, the British Mandate, and how did this play out?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic because there's been a lot of a focus on boycotts of late, primarily because of the impact of BDS, boycott of Israeli institutions and so on and so forth. And yet, historically, if you look at the record, most of the boycott activity has been on the Jewish or Zionist side of the register. The Conquest of Labor campaign, which is the name given to the efforts that you were describing, from really the 1910s onwards, were this sort of concerted effort to put pressure on Jewish employers to exclude Arabs from the workforce in all areas of the economy, including agriculture. And the origins of the kibbutz, which is much lionized, also lay in that initiative, because there were all sorts of efforts made on the part of Jewish pioneers to find a sustainable source of employment in agriculture in the Middle East, and they failed until the kibbutz offered a solution through pooled resources. It was much cheaper and more effective to pull resources collectively. And this was the only way they could figure out to basically have an Arab free workforce, Arab free economy. But in the urban sector, it was much more difficult to do that. And so that required a lot of very heavy handed pressure on employers to abide by this boycott of Arab labor. And it was never really terribly successful. At least according to my research, all the way up through the mandate, through the wartime period, again, if employers had the leeway to hire according to their preference, they would go for Arab labor for the reasons I mentioned earlier. After 1948, that was a period when there was an effort on the part of the new Israeli state to import a replacement workforce, mostly Mizrahi Jews from Arab countries in the region. And at that time, the Palestinians who were left inside the Israeli state were under military lockdown, and they couldn't travel from their villages very easily. So effectively, they were shut out of the workforce, but only for a short period of time. And it wasn't long before you really begin to see the record of them showing up again on construction workforces, and the numbers in terms of the participation grew really from the early 1950s onwards. 1967, there's a whole new opportunity that opens up with the occupation to tap a reservoir of cheap labor in the West Bank and in Gaza. And the Israeli economy really developed on the back of that cheap labor from 1967 onwards. And ever since then, the dependency on that cheap labor from the West Bank has proven very difficult to shake off, despite, again, efforts to replace that workforce by importing migrant workers from overseas. It remains the case that today, just in terms of sheer numbers, there are more Palestinians from the West Bank working in Israel and on the settlements than ever previously. So the numbers are at an all-time high. That's the historical span of the story, at least.
Sure. And I should say that I'm speaking with Andrew Ross about his book, Stone Men, The Palestinians Who Built Israel. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, staying with the historical elements of this story for a moment, one of the things that you emphasize in Stone Men is the symbolic importance of stone for the Israelis and for the Palestinians. And that significance actually shifts over time. It's not just one notion. And I wonder if you could talk about the building of Tel Aviv next to the Palestinian city of Jaffa and how stone was seen in that tale.
Yeah, it's an interesting case study because Tel Aviv is one of the cities, of course, that the Palestinian stonemasons built. They not only built villages, hilltop villages and palaces and township cores all over historic Palestine, but they also built the cities that we know the names of now quite well, Haifa and Hebron and Bethlehem and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which was supposed to be the first Hebrew city. But in terms of the ability to work with stone, in the case of Tel Aviv, it was the stonemasons of Jaffa who were expected to do the construction in that part of the land. And they were working with a coastal sandstone called Kurkar, which they were obviously very skilled in working with. And when settlers decided to build a Jewish suburb of Jaffa, at the time Jaffa was the economic and cultural capital of Palestine, with almost 100,000 people by the time of the Nakba, it would have been an obvious choice to turn to those stone masons. But under the influence of the Conquest of Labor campaign, the funders of Tel Aviv, mostly from World Jewry, were asking the city fathers to only employ Jewish workers, and that the city would be built by Jewish hands. That was very difficult to do because of the labor market at the time, and would have introduced no end of conflict, and was beginning to do so. And so what happened was that there was an effort to find a technological substitute for the sandstone, which was readily available in the region. And so initially silicate bricks were invented and applied, and eventually concrete and cement was brought in to be used as a primary building material. And over time, a cult of concrete developed not just in Tel Aviv, but more generally in the new Israeli state in the 1950s and the 1960s. And but it's important to understand, and this is a story I tell in the book, that the original choice of that material was made in order to exclude the stonemasons of Jaffa. In addition, there was a wholesale effort to eradicate all the physical remnants of that building, traditional or vernacular building in the region, after the Nakba, when villages were demolished and urban quarters were eradicated. And this really continued until 1967. The story that I tell after 1967 is that the flight away from the regional styles went into reverse. A lot of the excavations of biblical archaeologists in Jerusalem sparked religious interest in the landscape of Jewish antiquity. And all of a sudden, Israeli Jews began to see the old stones of Palestine through new eyes. They were no longer seen as a crumbling legacy of a backward civilization, but as sort of reminders of the ancient Jewish birthright to be reclaimed. And so what you really saw was this, in Jerusalem at least, the religious appetite for old stones. In Tel Aviv, which is much more of a secular city, the secular appetite for the real estate value of antique stone buildings begins to pick up speed and pace from the 1980s and 1990s. And this isn't something, of course, is unique to Tel Aviv or to Israel. We've seen this all over the world and in cities where there's a and it's associated with gentrification, this new evaluation of antique stone and antique decor and so on and so forth. And by the time I started doing my reporting in Jaffa and Tel Aviv in 2015, this meant that some of the old buildings in Jaffa were fetching the highest real estate prices in Israel. And Kurkar, which is this local sandstone that had been shunned a century before by Tel Avivians, had become a very sought-after item, along with the skills needed to work with Kurkar. And this was just an astonishing reversal, in a way, because it wasn't that long ago that that the old stone was being, you know, slated for demolition.
Sure, and you write about how this shift, which took place after the seizure of the occupied territories in 1967, that in the period before that, the Israeli state had projected an image of itself in terms of the aesthetics of its buildings that was modern, and, you know, that Tel Aviv was inspired by the Bauhaus and concrete, and when they demolished Palestinian villages, they then planted forests of European trees over these villages to sort of eradicate this past. But then there was this switch to drawing on an ancient past of mm-hmm. one that reinforced the notion that Jews had a birthright, mm-hmm. as a right to Palestinian land. And so it's a pretty significant shift, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I mean, it wasn't overnight, but it had a local significance that was heavily politicized. But you can see that sea change in taste happening all over the world. We think about the period of urban renewal in countries like this, where a lot of old buildings were cleared away during the 50s and 60s and early 70s, and then the whole paradigm of historical preservation kicked in, and now these old buildings are lovingly restored. This is, you know, a well-known real estate story about gentrification now in Israel, it had this intense political significance, however, that is difficult to avoid and is astonishing in retrospect. If you go 25 kilometers east of Tel Aviv, on the other side of the Green Line in the West Bank, there's also a movement to restore and preserve traditional stone and mortar buildings. It has nothing to do with real estate value, however, because at least not yet, old houses and historic centers don't have that kind of, command of value in the real estate market. There are other reasons why the restoration and conservation efforts are taking place, and I devoted quite a bit of attention in the book to covering those restoration initiatives.
Well, tell us more about that. What does that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, part of it is about cultural heritage. The revitalization of interest and value in all aspects of Palestinian cultural heritage, which is quite typical of a culture that is in an anti-colonial phase, and stonemasonry is certainly part of that heritage. There are other reasons that are perhaps are even more urgent that have a direct impact on the survival of the Palestinian people on their land. One of them has to do with the need to stave off seizure by settlers. If you're restoring buildings and putting them on inventories of historically listed buildings, it's a little more difficult for settlers to seize the land and the buildings. And in addition, because some of the restoration efforts are connected to initiatives that involve the restoration of traditional agriculture in some of these ancient hilltop villages, it also redirects economic attention to the land itself, and again makes it more difficult for settlers to grab that land.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Andrew Ross about his book, Stone Men, The Palestinians Who Built Israel. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Andrew Ross is professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. So I wanted to turn to the part of the story of the stonework done by Palestinians and the story of their labor, which is really at the heart of your book. And there has been a great deal of attention for people who are concerned about Palestine and Israel. There's been a great deal of focus on land, and not surprisingly, because the dispossession of Palestinian land by the Israeli settler state has been a primary dimension of what has taken place there. But in many ways, the story of labor gets obscured, and you're arguing that they're pretty fundamentally linked, the story of land dispossession and the story of the exploitation of Palestinian land and people being forced into, by necessity, by economic necessity, constructing the Israeli settler project with their labor and with the land that's taken from them, and the stones are drawn from that land. So, although this story goes, you've been tracing it through the 20th century, tell us about the seizure of the occupied territories in 1967, that role that that played in the story of Palestinian land and labor.
Yes, everything you said, I think, really feeds into one of the reasons for writing the book. This neglect of Palestinian livelihoods, since most of the attention of Palestine watchers internationally is on certainly things like population displacement and land seizure and human rights violations, soldier brutality, mass incarceration, and the like, and all for very good reasons. But it has meant that there's been a corresponding lack of attention to how Palestinian families put bread on the table on a daily basis and what their livelihoods are. And I decided that that I would, what I basically did was follow the stone and the supply of labor as it moves from the quarries into the workshops and factories in the West Bank, and then moves across the Green Line into Israel itself, and also in the settlements in the West Bank. So basically, I was following the journey of the stone and the labor, and interviewing workers at every point in that chain. So I did my interviews in the quarries and the factories and at the checkpoints, and on construction sites, and also in their homes. Especially in villages that were close to the settlements, because a large number of villagers are obliged for one reason or another to work in the settlements that are close to their villages and are in the process of grabbing land from their villages. So a lot of these workers are actually working on land that had been owned and used not that long ago by their villages and sometimes by their families. And so the psychology of this is, you know, intensely painful and intensely humiliating, not just in the case of the settlements, but actually in the case of the construction of the wall. The separation wall is largely built with Palestinian labor, and the people who have no alternative but to do those jobs, as you can imagine, is particularly painful and humiliating. The point I think you were referring to earlier in your question about the interplay between land and labor is, it's a story that is, you find in any sort of settler colonial history, where they're alongside the effort, the ongoing effort to take over land, to seize land, the labor of the indigenous population is utilized at the same time, and it's the balance between these two that that forms the basis for a colonial economy in a settler state, and Palestine is no exception to that, of course. So the long-term story about why Palestinians are the preferred labor force in construction is that the more and more they were inducted into wage labor in construction industry and moved off the land, in other words, away from agricultural livelihoods, their attachment to the land was weakened as a result. And therefore, again, it becomes easier for settlers to take over that land. And so that the transfer of labor off the land is a long-term story here that that has been ongoing at least since, you know, since 1967 and the onset of the occupation, and it continues to this day. And that's one of the reasons why the restoration efforts that I referred to earlier are trying to redirect attention to, you know, local agriculture and local supply of food, and revive some of those networks on the land that they used to be so important and have been ruptured as a result of the induction of so many workers into wage labor for want of an alternative livelihood. And I say that because I describe this workforce as a compulsory workforce. It's not forced labor. No one's really forcing Palestinians to cross the Green Line and work in Israeli construction sites. But because there are no alternatives, no sustainable alternatives on the West Bank, you cannot put bread on the table in most other livelihoods. They have no alternative but to do this. So I call it a compulsory workforce.
And isn't that also one of the characteristics of many settler states, which is that the labor force, the indigenous labor force, is controlled in all sorts of ways, which also changes the cost of labor. And that's to say nothing of other labor also being brought in from outside. How do you see that dimension of this story?
It's very important because the situation as it exists is really a win-win situation for the Israeli economy and Israeli employers. The migrant labor from overseas can be pit against the Palestinian labor from the West Bank and to drive down wages. The reason, however, why Palestinians from the West Bank are still preferred is because they go home every night, so they don't make, it's a commuter workforce, basically, so they don't make demands on the Israeli state in the form of services. A lot of them speak Hebrew, which is a big asset for communicating with employers, and some of them have long-standing relationships with employers. But most importantly, they don't send their wages home, as it were, in the form of remittances, as migrant workers do all across the world. They spend their wages in the West Bank on Israeli goods at Israeli prices, because that's what's on offer. These are the goods that you can buy in the West Bank. And so that's very good for the Israeli economy in general. And so at all levels, there are distinct advantages to using the Palestinian labor. The icing on the cake is that this economic policy is a very effective policy of pacification, in addition, because if you're issued with a work permit, you're a Palestinian worker, you're issued with a work permit, it's very vital that you retain that work permit, and or you get cut off, your livelihood gets cut off. So what happens is that if any member of your family, even a distant relative, gets into trouble, steps out of line, is arrested or incarcerated, then you stand to lose your permit. And so, as you can see, it's not just an economic policy, it's also a policy of political pacification. There's a built-in incentive not to be resistant in ways that might turn out to be militant.
Andrew Ross is my guest. He is the author of Stone Men, The Palestinians Who Built Israel, published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. When you did your interviews of Palestinian workers who worked in the stone industry, whether it's quarrying or cutting stone or finishing stone, and you talked to them about how they saw their situation, their plight, were there any generalizations that you feel you can make about their political orientation or perspective? You note in the book that workers in the building trades in many parts of the world can tend to be more conservative.
Yes.
Is that the case with the Palestinians who you talk to?
I think to some degree, yes. And largely because, the jobs and the possibility of more work depends on, you know, growth and building of all kinds. And ironically and very painfully, the fact is, if a settlement, an Israeli settlement, Jewish settlement in the West Bank is expanding and building more houses, it does mean more work for Palestinians in that region, in the immediate backyard. They're the ones that are going to be hired. They're the ones who are going to be building. And so there, at some level, there is a material interest and an economic interest in growth, even though it's not in the national interest, obviously, and it's working for the occupier, and it's building out the occupation. When you have to put food on the table at the end of the day, it's a no-brainer. However, for most of these workers, now I did. You know, I did encounter workers and families who refused to work in the settlements, That was a very difficult choice for them to make, especially if they couldn't get a permit to go and work in Israel. You don't need a permit to work in the settlement, so it was an option for people in that predicament. But so it's difficult to generalize. For sure, I was interested in the interviews and plumbing the psychology of humiliation. Workers were very much aware of how their livelihoods are tossed around as colonial bargaining chips. You know, they're permitted to work for the occupier in return for keeping the peace. But I was more interested, really, quite frankly, in just in documenting their daily struggles from, you know, the moment they get up, which is often very early in the morning. They stand in line for hours at checkpoints. They work through the day. They spend an awful amount of time commuting. And when they get back at the end of the day, at nighttime, there's really only a small portion of their day left for their families and a limited amount of time to sleep before they're up and at it again. And I was really interested in documenting that daily routine, which I found hadn't been really done before in any thick detail. And I was really struck by their resilience, how they're resolutely always there, standing in line, showing up for work, despite all of the indignities and obstacles thrown in their path on a daily basis. They've been doing this, you know, decade in, decade out. And it's this kind of resilience that really, to me, I interpreted it as their own version of what is often called sumud among Palestinians, which is a resistance philosophy of steadfastness, which was developed after 1967. This commitment to exist, not to be moved, not to be evicted, not to be chased off, not to be sent off in flight. And although, as I say, there was a certain resident conservatism politically among these workers, their expression of sumud took this other form of this resilience. It was in the face of typically thankless treatment, not only on the other side of the Green Line, but also by employers in the stone industry itself. I interviewed a lot of, you know, owners of stone firms, and I got a sense of the owners' mentality and how well they were doing, how well they were profiting from this industry and the exploitation of workers.
And these are Palestinian owners?
Yes, they're small family. It's a small family-owned industry. Same family names crop up again and again. And it's a village-based economy. And so it's a very careful... It's an ethos of what I call careful competition among those families. It's not necessarily a predatory, cutthroat economy because they coexist in the villages and have lived with each other for a long, long time. It's quite distinct from the other economy in the West Bank, which is more of a crony capitalist economy. Again, typical of a colonial economy where you have a comprador class of native capitalists who do quite well and who profit by doing the bidding and providing the supply of labor and local resources for the outside capitalists who are more in control. But there's a need for a native capitalist class, and there certainly is that in Palestine. They're grouped around the Palestinian Authority, and they hold monopolies on a lot of the utilities and provision of goods from Israel. They tend not to have very much to do with the stone industry, which again is a small family-owned business. The other people who are doing very well out of this economy are Palestinian, on the Palestinian side, are the middlemen, who are the labor contractors, who take their cut from the supply of labor. So they'll charge for permits, they'll charge all sorts of fees, none of which are legal, but in every migrant labor supply in the world, you're going to have these middlemen who are taking a cut as brokers are providing some service to get the worker from A to B. And that is the case also in the West Bank, as I found.
Tell us about the planned community for affluent Palestinians, Rawabi, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yes. Rawabi is a very controversial city being built on a hill just north of Ramallah. And there's not a Palestinian who doesn't have a very strong opinion about Rawabi. It's often referred to as the Palestinian settlement because a lot of its building and the look and the feel of Rawabi is echoes the structure and the feel of Jewish settlements on the West Bank. It's not cheap to buy in there, for sure. It's primarily marketed to the Palestinian middle class, it's a pretty awesome thing to see, this city on a hill, unlike any other settlement in Palestine, other than the Israeli ones. And so I did quite a bit of interviewing among the executive class there, some of the workers, and also drew some conclusions about the role of Rawabi in the financialization of the Palestinian economy, because that's another big story that hasn't received a whole lot of attention. We've seen household debt rising in almost every developed country as a result of financialization. And at a certain point after the Oslo Accords in the mid-1990s, banks began to operate in the West Bank and offer all kinds of high-interest loans, with the result that you've really seen household debt shoot up. Everyone wants a car. Everyone wants a house or an apartment. And at this point in time, large proportion of the Palestinian population is heavily saddled with debt. And the building of initiatives like Rawabi, of course, are heavily debt financed because they depend on long-term mortgages. The introduction of the long-term mortgage in the West Bank in the late 1990s was quite a significant event. And for me, it's really an extraordinary example of how, you know, financialization can operate like business as usual in almost anywhere. I mean, if you think about it, this is highly politically unstable landscape, the West Bank. Who knows what's going to happen? People really don't know what their, in the short term, their destinies are going to be. And yet banks are operating according to business as usual, offering these, you know, long-term loans. Kind of surprising.
Yeah. Well, let me end by asking you about the potential or the reality of labor solidarity beyond or between Palestinian workers, who we've been talking about extensively in this hour, the foreign workers who were brought in, especially after the first Intifada in the late 80s, to try and replace them. And then Israeli workers. What potential do you see for alliances despite the intense divisions that are created by a settler state?
Yeah, there are a number of new unions that have sprung up on either side of the Green Line that are relatively independent of the main federations, the main trade union federations in the West Bank and in Israel. And I focus a good bit of attention in my book to those particular unions and discovered there is sort of informal cooperation across the green line between them in some cases. It's very difficult to do that for all sorts of reasons, but it's happening, and there have been some wins and gains. You know, there's an Israeli trade union that organized workers in the West Bank settlement and won contracts. So it's not possible for Palestinian trade unions to do that. And there have also been wins and gains in Israel on behalf of Palestinian wage workers in the construction industry as a result of these, you know, these new unions. So so that's an interesting development. The bigger argument, I think, that I end the book up with is this argument about what I call political sweat equity, which is an argument that after a century or more of Palestinians basically building Israel in one fashion or another, I mean, Palestinian hands have been decisive in almost every fixed asset on the land for the last 100 years or so, what kind of rights accrue from that long inventory of labor? On the principle that, you know, people who build a nation or who build a country have a claim on rights within the polity of that country. And so I'm kind of arguing that the Palestinian workers have earned their full civil and political rights in the future unitary state, because more and more people are talking about the, you know, the one state, the unitary state solution to the conflicts in the region. And I feel that those arguments for political sweat equity are should be on the table in any future negotiation, if and when negotiations commence around the final settlement. Then this record of toil, century of toil on the part of Palestinians, should be something that should be reckoned with and accounted for.
Andrew Ross, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you for having me on your show.
I've been speaking with the author of Stone Men, The Palestinians Who Built Israel. That's published by Verso, and its author is Andrew Ross. He is professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.